I really like these figures. These figures are like the stock figures in a Victorian melodrama. This is the way that we think of Victorian women, right? The shrinking ingenue, she's wearing pink, the woeful widow. The woman in the middle, I have some doubts. Perhaps she's one of those people we were talking about before. But in any case, the women I'm going to introduce you to tonight don't fit into these categories. I'm talking about business women. This is how I defined it. Any woman who was making money, but not through wages. In other words, she's not doing wage work. She's not being paid by the piece. She's running a small business, usually self-employed. Everything from peddlers to women running large incorporated businesses. My period is between 1830 and 1885. All of them are from the city of Albany. I had very few sources because when I started this project 13 or 14 years ago, I was going to look at milliners, women who made hats in Albany. I thought maybe I would find 50 women in business. I would find out everything about them, and I would find out why they were so exceptional and why they defied the mores of their time. Well, first of all, there were more than 200 milliners in business for themselves, and they made up about 5% of the business women in Albany that I looked at. So I began to think there's a bigger story here, bigger than milliners, and someone else had just done her PhD on milliners and dressmakers, and I was just starting. So, well, scratch that. I'm going to do business women in general, and my sources were city directories, the same sources we were talking about, that just give the names and the addresses, the manuscript census of population. And since I looked at the census of 1880, I had to go through 90,000 names line by line. And I did that twice, actually. And credit records. This was my major source, and this is the source of the stories that I'm going to talk about tonight. At Harvard Business School, they have the credit ledgers from the R.G. Dunn Company. They checked every business on the East Coast, maybe throughout the country. It was sort of spotty in other places, but certainly on the East Coast. Male or female, any business of any size was evaluated as to whether it was creditworthy. The source begins, the ledgers begin in 1840, they end in 1885. For Albany, the books are about this big, this wide, this thick. There are 8 or 9 of them. They're written in this tiny, tiny little writing, and they're also in this kind of shorthand. So it takes a little while to figure out what they're saying. But I identified more than 700 women in the credit records. In addition to that, in the city directories alone, in 1813, there are 32 women in business. In 1830, 60 women in business. In 1885, 495 women in business in Albany. When you put all these numbers together, I have identified by name more than 2,000 women. And then I stopped because 10 years later, I had to finish. And you see, this was just with the 2,000 names, so that was fat enough. Anyway, today I'm going to tell you some general facts and then some stories. The overview, what trades were these women involved in? This is in the most common to the least common. The greatest number were dressmakers, followed by grocers, boarding house keepers, saloon keepers, dry and fancy goods dealers. And fancy goods dealers would sell materials, but trimmings. Sometimes they also sold hats. Milliners, confectioners and candy dealers, variety store owners. It took me a long time to figure out what variety store owners were, but Virginia Penny in the 19th century wrote about them that they sold small quantities of necessities, even wood and water, kinds of things that, coal, kinds of things that working class people needed to buy in small quantities. Liquor dealers, and then the smaller ones, peddlers, bakers, cigar dealers, hairdressers, dealers in hair goods and hair jewelry. Reorganized into broad categories, 41% of them provided food and or drink, 36% produced, sold, or cleaned clothing, 16% ran small shops, 15% provided lodging and boarding, and all other areas were less than 5%. Statistically, the average businesswoman in Albany would have been a middle-aged, widowed dressmaker, white, foreign-born, and the mother of adult children. However, that's not exactly accurate, because even though most businesswomen were dressmakers and most were middle-aged, in fact, if you looked at just dressmakers, they were more likely to be a little bit younger and to be single, whereas saloon keepers were more likely to be older and widowed. But luckily for you, I'm not going to talk about statistics tonight. I have a statistics talk, but you don't have to hear it. I'm so delighted that I'm going to talk about stories, because historians, it's a little suspect if you talk to them about stories. You know, you have to have analysis, not just stories. So I've got stories in four categories: the expected, the unexpected, the remarkable, and the scandalous. So we'll end somewhat like the last paper. And then I'm going to talk about mysteries. And the mysteries are the questions I have not yet answered because of the nature of my sources. I actually believe I can find the answers to many of these questions, but I haven't had time yet because I spent so much time, sort of plowing through these other sources. Now that I have the 2,000 names, I can go out and find out more about these people. All right, so what's the first expected? It's this woman over here, the worthy widow, forced to business by her loss of a husband, right? That's what we expect. And as an example of that, I'm going to mention a woman named Alida Hendrickson. She ran a dry goods store on South Pearl Street from 1850 to 1865. And she started in business when she's about 45. According to the credit entries, in 1856, she's described as a widow lady with a small store and a small stock, but of good character and reputation. In 1858, she was called honest and attentive, and it said she did a good business. In 1859, a very industrious, worthy woman does her own work and has always supported her family. In 1860, she was called much respected. In 1861, does a snug little business. This is getting good. They only use the word snug rarely. It means that some money is being made here. 1862, has three enterprising sons, two in the store with her. In 1863, she's honest, upright, and worthy of credit. This is a big step too. Most of these credit evaluations for women basically say not worthy of credit. Should be sold COD. Small means, small credit. So to say worthy of credit, she's getting up there. And finally, in 1865, there's an entry for Benjamin Hendrickson, her son. It says, son of Mrs. H., single, about 24 years, understands the business, has been a clerk for his mother a long time, active and attentive. His mother is good, which means good for credit. So this is a positive story, and this is the worthy widow, you know, running the business, supporting the family, then passing it on to the sons. The mystery, of course, is sort of what happened to her husband. Did he run a business? In fact, in 1847, there is one credit entry for him which says, quit business, little or no means, not much of a businessman. So perhaps it was lucky for the family that he passed on and she took over. Anyway. We next have these struggling spinster sisters. This, I think, is such an image that we have of the Victorian era, forced to take on a business because they have no other means of survival. These sisters were Mary and Ella Hartnett. They were milliners and dressmakers. At one point, they're on South Pearl Street, at another point on Hudson Street. And they're in business from 1860 to 1877. In 1860, they're aged 26 and 24, in business but a short time, good character and habits, means modest. Means means how much money they have to put into the business. In 1862, they're called honest working women. In 1866, good, steady, industrious girls. In 1867, limited in circumstances, but honest. In 1869, they take on a partner, Miss McDowell. She has small capital. She brings about $200 into the business now. At this time in Albany, $3 a week was a fairly standard wage for a woman. So, you know, I figure just multiply everything by 100, and you have some comparison to today's costs and prices and values. They had about $2,000, and they spent some expense fitting up their store. In 1870, they were called industrious girls but struggling along. In 1873, their partnership dissolved, and Mary stays in business by herself, still called a steady, hardworking young lady. Then it says she sold out to Ellen. Then under Ellen, it says, bought out her cousin, M.H., advise care. Then, we think her buying out her sister-in-law was bogus, merely a cover for Mrs. M.H., who was embarrassed and could not pay her debts. And by 1877, not having any business for herself, now no good anyway. Well, this is a sad story of the struggling sisters. The mysteries here, were they sisters? Were they cousins? Who was this sister-in-law? And what brought on their failure? We know that there was a big depression in the United States in 1873, so it's not so surprising that around this time they failed. And whatever happened to Miss McDowell, their partner who came in? She was interesting because there's a little story about her in the credit records. It says she worked for another business for William Ryder at $10 a week. Now let me tell you, in the 1860s, this was a princely sum for a woman to be making. She asked for a raise, and when he failed to give it, she quit and went into business with the Hartnetts, but then she's never heard of again. Did she lose her investment? You know, whatever happened to her? Okay, expected story number three, the self-sacrificing mother. Charlotte Armington was a widow. She was a milliner. She was on South Pearl Street, which was the most common place for milliners to be. She's in business from 1847 to 1877. Her first credit record, 1852, means small, very industrious. 54, honest, industrious, and attentive. Location not very good. 1855, has a little shop and does a small business. 1857, a member of the church. So you know she's very respectable. Is trying to get a living but has two very hard boys to take care of. 1858, has to support a family, a widow with several children. Two of her sons have given her a great deal of trouble. 59, a widow with quite a family to support, has expensive family, troublesome boys, good character every way. 1863, widow supports her family out of her business, hard-working woman. 74, good, respectable widow woman. 75, in business many years and has always paid as she agreed. 1877, dead. Now, one of the mysteries might be how she survived so long with all these being put upon so much. The other thing I wanted is, what did her sons do that was so bad? You know, what was their misbehavior? According to the city directories, they worked as a varnisher, a store clerk, a piano tuner, and a painter. But perhaps it was something they were doing on their off times. All right, so those are the expected stories, I think. But I also found stories that were common that I had not expected. Well, I found unexpected stories that were common and uncommon. The first one actually is more uncommon. It's the story of the domineering mother as opposed to the self-sacrificing mother. So let's look at the domineering mother. This woman was named Jacobina Teets, and she sold and manufactured pianos from 1872 to 1885. Now in 1868, her husband, Frederick Teets, was running a small concern, repairing and occasionally manufacturing organs. In 1870, it was called a very small affair, and it says COD, you know, cash on delivery. Don't let her get any credit. Let him get any credit. 2 years later, though, it said, everything belongs to his wife. She is the head of the concern. And later that year, suddenly, on June 21st, 1872, the note, he was cut to pieces by the cars at the Union Depot this morning. So that's the end of Frederick. In 1875, says business now done by his wife. She sells a great number of cheap class pianos manufactured in New York. Sales are principally on the installment plan. Now, this was fairly unusual in this period. To people in modest circumstances only, a very shrewd businesswoman. In 1877, she was called careful and saving, but with very peculiar ways. She's doing as well, if not better, than any other dealer in pianos here. She sells altogether on the installment plan, giving long time. In other words, she let them pay over a long period of time and makes collections promptly. She claims to have as high as $40,000 worth of pianos trusted out in this manner, and claims she has 20,000 more invested in a New York firm manufacturing pianos. However, the credit examiners do not approve of this. It is thought that Mrs. T is blowing her own horn rather too much when she claims to have $60,000 invested outside her stock in the store. And it is a hard matter to get an estimate of over $30,000 on her worth. Well, let's face it, $30,000 was a pretty high estimate for a woman in business at this time. She's regarded as a very careful woman who will not be caught napping. She was also reputed sharp, shrewd woman, and of exceeding quick temper. In 1880, there's an entry for Frederick Tietz again. This is her son. But he has not taken over the business. Is son of Mrs. F.W. Tietz, and was at one time in the employ of his mother. But being unable to agree, he started business for himself some months ago. A hard-working young man of good habits. They're, by the way, on the same street. This is a mother and child in competition in the same business on the same street. 1881. She has the name of taking severe measures to enforce payments. I don't know if she had, you know, like bullies going. I don't know. You know, it's you really wonder, what is she doing? Severe measures. It is said that she is a hard woman to deal with and has many disputes about the correctness of bills, etc. Under her son, Frederick Tietz, his business is not paying him anything over his expenses at the present time, owing to the competition existing between himself and his mother and the other dealers here. Now, in 1882, Jacobina Tietz's business begins to fall on hard times. She shows evidence of being hard up and tries to transfer the business to the name of her daughter, who also works for her. The credit examiners are very suspicious and say, if proceedings were taken against her, it would no doubt transpire that the business was owned by some other member of the family. She's up to all the technicalities of the law and is shrewd enough to take advantage of any point that might be in her favor. The final step for Jacobina Tietz comes in 1883. The building she occupies was partly destroyed by fire today, and her stock of pianos, etc., was badly damaged by water. She is understood to have had no insurance. Now, with this story, you would have thought that perhaps she had had insurance, but no. And her name then disappears, but her son continues in business, and I think 10 years later is running something called, like, the Tietz Emporium of Music. So he does succeed, there's no sign that they ever... You know, do they ever get back together? Why does he leave? What was really going on there? What about the daughter? Had she been working in the business? Had she thought she was going to inherit the mother's business before it failed? Okay, so that's an uncommon, unexpected story. There's also a common, unexpected story, the story that I did not expect when I started, the story of the worthless husband. And this occurs many, many times in the credit records. One of these husbands was a man named Asa Roberts, who was the husband of Mrs. A.C. Roberts. They never say her name, though I know it was Mary. She's also a milliner. For some reason, the milliners appear very much in the credit records, and they appear in the early period where the entries are more interesting. As the credit records go on, the entries get blander. In the 1840s and 50s, they're much spicier. Anyway, she's on North Pearl Street, then on Chapel. She's in business from 1830 to 1883. She starts when she's 17, and she ends business when she's 70. In 1840, her business is called Very Good. But in 1842, they say she has a poor, lazy husband whom she supports, deemed one of our most best and fashionable milliners and herself most industrious. In 1843, her husband too lazy to have any business. 1850, has to support a good-for-nothing husband. And when they write nothing, they write 00. It's so cute. But she is an excellent milliner, very attentive and industrious, and of good character. Her husband is said to be a lawyer in New York, a sort of pimp living off his wife. In 1853, her husband is an extravagant fellow who runs fast horses and spends the money as fast as she makes it. In 1855, does business in her own name, but has a husband who is a shiftless sort of fellow. She supports the family and is considered a first-rate businesswoman. 1860, she still has a fashionable and profitable trade. 1863, a hard-working woman supports her husband. 1876, used to be good but has fallen behind. Well, the poor thing. She's been in business since 1830. In 1878, it says she's out of business. In 1883, she is a person quite advanced in years, does only a small business, is regarded as strictly honest. But if she should drop off suddenly, as one of her age is likely to do, creditors might suffer. So you could be in business so long, but if your credit is iffy. Anyway, the mystery's here. How did she feel about her husband? Did she agree with the credit examiners? Or was she perfectly happy with their relationship? Did she enjoy running her business? And, you know, or did she think that he was a no good, shiftless louse? And if so, why did they stay together? Because people did divorce in this period. However, we're going to hear an even more worthless husband who we know his wife didn't like. We speak now of a man named John Denmead. He was the husband of Sarah Denmead, and they ran a trimmings, fancy goods, and millinery business on South Pearl Street, later on Broadway, later on North Pearl, from 1855 to 1876. In 1857, the credit entry said, his wife has for many years carried on business, been industrious and successful, supported him and his family. He is a drunken, lazy loafer. His wife has desired several times for him to leave her forever, but like a bad scent, he always returns. He lately, pistol in hand, drove her from her store, threatened her life, took all her goods, and is selling them out. He deserves no credit, but instead a steady home in Sing Sing. Now, according to Victorian literature, what is this woman going to do? She is going to shrivel up and die. She is going to live with relatives. No. In 1858, she's doing a good business. The wife is the principal businessman of the concern and has made considerable money. She attends to the business. He drinks and runs after women in the meantime. She hires him to go away. Every once in a while, and when he comes back again, she hires him to go away again. The entry of 1860 is a masterpiece of understatement. Under the name of John Denmead, it says, has had domestic difficulties. Doing better now. 1861, his wife is the boss. 1862, same. Wife is the man of the house. John is a fish, loves to swim, but wants it inside. My husband said, what does that mean? He drinks. That's what it means. And then once you know that, and you see other credit records that describe somebody as being a fish, then you know what that means. 1863, his wife is the active man. Whenever a businesswoman is really good, they call her a man. 1864, same, likes his glass of ale. 1865, John is again drunken. His wife supports him. Thinks she is sharp enough to keep what she makes out of his hands. 68, John, her husband, was formerly a great drinker, but has reformed. She is a smart, shrewd woman. Business still conducted in her name. This she insists upon for fear he should break out again. And in fact, in 1848, there was a Married Woman's Property Rights Act in New York. The exact effects of this are not clear to me because clearly the women I look at are not paying attention to the law. They are running businesses and making arrangements without worrying about, you know, who has the legal right. And you can see here, in the beginning, he has the legal right to her goods, but she finds ways to control him with the money that she makes. 69, wife is a good businesswoman. He is only in ordinary capacity. So even when he's sober, he's not that helpful. Formerly was dissipated, but now is steadier. In 1872, they moved to a new store. This was bad timing for them, right before the Depression of 1873. They have a good run of custom, and they're worth $4,000 or $5,000. Suddenly in 1872, you get the entry, endeavoring to compromise at 25 cents. In other words, for 25 cents on the dollar for their debts. Some have accepted, but don't think they will all accept. He states that his eyesight was failing him, and he was incapacitated for business. Now, come on. Could that matter? He sold out to his wife and son. The whole affair looks suspicious. Wife and son are carrying on the business under the style of Z and S Denmead. Zachariah was their son. By 1873, Z and S Denmead had failed about a year ago. In 1874, now Sarah Denmead, Z and S dissolved. She has no means except what is furnished by John D. Now, I think this is so unfair. He didn't have any means except what was furnished by her. But in any case, who failed some time ago? And in 1876, they moved to Buffalo. Well, the mystery could be why they went to Buffalo or what happened then. But in 1885, in the city directory, there's an entry for Sarah Denmead. She's the matron of the Albany City Homeopathic Hospital. And a matron would be, you know, sort of a supervisory person. John Denmead, however, is listed separately in the Home for Aged Men on Troy Road. And when I read this, really the hair stood up on the back of my neck. I thought, she really got him. She stuck him in the Home for Aged Men while she took on a new career. Okay, so we've had the expected. We've had the unexpected. Now I'm going to talk about the truly remarkable. One of the problems is whenever a woman is in business, it's so remarkable. How did she do it? You know, going against the ideas of her time. But really, there were these hundreds and thousands of businesswomen. But which ones were remarkable? I'm going to mention two. The first is a woman named Julia Ridgway. Anybody ever heard of Julia Ridgway? You have heard of Julia Ridgway, or you're just nodding your head. Yeah. Julia Ridgway was a plumbing entrepreneur, and her career illustrates how a businesswoman of exceptional drive and vision could move to the top, even in a trade that might have been assumed to be closed to women. She's widowed in 1851 at the age of 26, and she regularly advertises her business in the city directories. She's running the New York State Plumbing Establishment, her name clearly, Julia Ridgway at the bottom. She describes herself as proprietress of the concern and licensed plumber to the Albany Waterworks. You notice her name in bold print, and at the top, a sink, a bathtub, and a toilet. At the bottom, a stove. You know, I really think this confounds our notions of Victorian modesty here. This woman and her plumbing. Okay, so she goes into business. She's a widow. She wants to make ends meet. What happens next? She provides the capital and keeps the books. And she hires men who do the mechanical part of the concern, supervise the actual plumbing work. Unlike even the most successful milliner or dressmaker, she's not an artisan carrying out her trade. She is the owner-manager of a large enterprise. She's also the mother of a four-year-old daughter at the time she begins this job. By 1865, so this is more than 10 years later, she's doing the best business of any firm or man in the line in Albany, undoubtedly making money, and her business is estimated worth $10,000. It's about 3 times the worth of the business when her husband died. The well-managed business continues to make money, providing Ridgway with funds to invest in real estate as well. One of her partners retires in 1871. Now, I would think this is the perfect chance for her to retire. She doesn't need the money. The business is doing fine. It could carry on. But no. Instead, she takes on a new partner. She continues to oversee and attend closely to the business, which is then worth $20,000. By the late 1870s, and I think that that's the second ad that we're going to take a look at. You can see the way the ads change as well. Ridgway and Russ Plumbers and Hydraulic Engineers, wholesale dealers and plumbers materials, plumbing done in any part of the country and warranted. This is about 25 years in business. Clearly, she's still promoting her business. She's expanding. She's picking up new ventures. 10 years later, in 1889, Ridgway and Russ added a telephone number to their advertisement, as well as a line announcing, "Telephone communications to all parts of the city, and we are prepared to furnish a plumber at any time during the night or day or on Sunday. I wish I could have their service now, myself." Anyway, those are all the visuals. The mysteries with Julia Ridgway, well, of course, you ask yourself, why? It's not surprising when a woman takes on a grocery. It's not surprising when she takes on a boarding house. It's not surprising when she takes on some field that's associated with domesticity or women's skills. But it's rather surprising for a woman to become the premier plumber in Albany. And I don't know why, because there may be some personal papers, because I haven't really looked yet, but there may not be. We may never know why she took this step. Catherine Blake. Catherine Blake was an African-American woman. She was married to a man named Adam Blake, who was a descendant of a slave who had belonged to the old patroon, which I presume is Stephen Van Rensselaer. In 1868, her husband opens a hotel. He's described by the credit records as a gentleman of color, which is set up in business by a subscription of citizens, and this is called Congress Hall. It's largely patronized by members of the New York State Legislature. Now, we don't know exactly what her part was in the beginning of this business. The hotel appears to have experienced a shaky beginning. There were debts to be paid, a slack summer season when the legislature was out of session. Her husband speculated in stock, and that had a negative impact on the business and its cash flow. But by 1878, the Blakes could afford to lease a newly constructed hotel, the Kenmore, one of the premier hotels in Albany. Yes, this is true. They were the first proprietors, and they paid an annual rent of $6,000. At one point, they were also running a summer hotel as well. Her husband was noted for his intemperate habits and indulging freely. Now, as I say, we don't know what her role was during this period, but her husband dies in 1881. At first, the credit records say she's going to dispose of the hotel as soon as she can do it to her advantage. But an offer of $50,000 did not suit her. And under her sole management, the concern prospered more than it had before. In 1882, she made money last year, and there is every reason to believe she will have done equally well this year, provided she does not sell out. There is now being an effort made by C.E. Leland of the Delavan House, a rival hotel, to buy her out, and some think he will succeed. She's been offered $50,000 for the business and furniture in the hotel, but asked $75,000 and will probably get that or nothing. And presumably she wasn't satisfied with the offer because she's still listed as the proprietress of the Kenmore Hotel until 1887, some 6 years after her husband's death. So there are so many mysteries connected with this. You know, what was the subscription of citizens? What was her role in the hotel? Why didn't she just take $50,000? Why hold out for $75,000? Did she ever get $75,000? Lots of interesting questions here. Okay, we're on to the scandalous. There are two people I would like to mention to you, Elizabeth Hempstead and Sarah Cresswell. We'll start with Elizabeth Hempstead. She was a married woman who operated her brothel behind the front of a millinery shop. And when I started on milliners, people said, well, milliners always known to be fronts for prostitution. Well, not in Albany. You know, one or two were. The rest were clearly millinery shops, at least according to the credit examiners. And believe me, they cared whether it was a brothel or not. They wouldn't leave that out. You know, all the other ones, good character, good habits, industrious, that's what they're looking for. In 1843, it was said that Elizabeth Hempstead had been in business for 5 years, and the entry stated rather obliquely that her reputation was not high. In 1849, it said, her moral character is of the worst kind. Her house is said to be one of ill fame. In 1850, she is worth about $4,000, but you cannot collect 4 cents from her. If she can cheat you, she will do it. In 1850, tricky. She belongs to a tricky family. Bad moral character. Well acquainted with a few Albanians beside her husband. Now, I'm so stupid. I'm reading this, like, Albanians. What is she doing with Albanians? Where were the Albanians coming from? Finally, I realized she's talking about men in Albany, right? Won't pay. Keep clear. Husband is a drunken loafer. Actually, her husband, Isaac Hempstead, was listed in the city directories as a physician and later as a commissioner of deeds, so I guess the fact that his wife ran a brothel and he was a drunken loafer did not stop him from taking on those duties. In 1851, the credit reports said that she was bad, very bad. And in 1852, she was called a bad egg. In 1853, engaged in more kinds of business than one, a notorious bad character would not trust her 25 cents. Bad as can be. If anybody trusts her, they deserve to lose their money. And you have to remember with the credit examiners, that's their major concern. Are the people who sell these people goods going to lose their money? In 1854, she was called dishonest, tricky, and unreliable, unworthy of credit, does not pay when she can, now doing business under cover of her foreman, a regular blazer. In 1855, a hard case, one of those low 25-cent places, dirt cheap, and the exclamation point. They seem much more upset about how little she's charging, right? Exclamation point. And you wonder, they know it's a brothel. Why do they keep going back year after year? You know, what is going on here? But nevertheless, in 1868, they say, good for nothing, don't credit. And finally, in 1872, after about 35 years in the trade, out of business, old prostitute, not in this line now. We end with Sarah Cresswell, the owner of a corset warehouse. Now, let me say, similar to your situation, I was reading Antonia Fraser's The Weaker Vessel, which is about women in 17th century England, and it turns out that Madame Cresswell was the name of a well-known operator of a bawdy house in 17th century England, so this may well have been a made-up name that indicated her trade. Because Fraser said it's frequently mentioned in the literature of the period, this name, Madame Cresswell. And she's English. The first entry, 1853. English lady, age 60, likes beer and drinks it moderately. So had you been, you know, going through her house, perhaps you would have found some beer bottles. In business a long time, would not trust her $5, never was first rate. 1854. This is my favorite line. She is a woman of large amativeness, loves to sport with strange men, either for money, living, or pleasure. Better cross her off the books and obliterate this piece of intelligence. A 25-cent concern, more or less. This was obviously the bottom going rate for prostitute in Albany, 25 cents. Keeps a bawdy house, exclamation point, exclamation point. causes old Dr. George Cook a good deal of business in the way of curing certain complaints. Now, Dr. George Cook, as we know, was the Albany doctor who took care of venereal cases. In the earlier city directories, he sometimes has a full-page ad clearly stating that that is his business, that is his specialty. 1856, let her rip. I wasn't sure what that meant, but I realized it meant rest in peace, she's dead. It says, and on her way to heaven. This is written in pen. Heaven is crossed out, and over that is written in pencil the word hell. Then, in 1857, dead, where is the doctor? Is he laying with her? And in hell, written in pencil over this. However, I can tell you the answer to this question. Dr. Cook was not in hell. He was in England, and he soon came back to Albany. Okay, those are my stories and my mysteries, and if anybody has any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.